Hello and welcome to the Interfish Podcast, where we bring you the most interesting and compelling seafood news. I'm Drew Cherry, Editor-in-Chief of Interfish, joined today by Executive Editor John Fiorillo and Correspondent John Evans in Brazil. Hello, gentlemen. Let's dive right in with the biggest story of the week. We only have time for a couple, but one definitely was a bombshell. John Fiorillo, I'm going to turn it over to you just to kick us off, and then we can start digging into the history a bit of this story. But tell us what happened this week, and let's talk about what it might mean.
Yeah, this week there was a settlement, an $85 million settlement against salmon farming companies that include Maui, Leroy, Salmar, Cermak, and Grieg. And it stems from a case where in the U.S. there were allegations of collusion and price fixing. It was a class action lawsuit led by Euclid Seafood, I think is the full name, Euclid Fish, maybe. Don't have it in front of me. But so they lost, or they didn't lose. They settled the case for $85 million, did not admit guilt or anything like that, but expressed the idea that, you know, this was going to save money in the long run because the legal process in the U.S. is drawn out and very costly. So, that's the essence of it. Now, the broader questions are, you know, what comes next? Is this the tip of the iceberg? Because there's some who believe that it is, that there is also a similar case ongoing in the EU, and that's been ongoing for several years, and that's what triggered this one. And the DOJ in the US is also opened a case along the same lines against roughly the same companies. So this could be more than it appears at the moment. And it's Euclid Fish Company, sorry.
Right, and Euclid is a small Ohio-based company. We've been trying to get a hold of them and have not had any luck. Maybe they're not interested in talking right now, but we'll keep on that. We'll get to them eventually, or their attorneys. It's quite common in the U.S. that this is these class action suits. I think we've talked about them before on the podcast, but an attorney will identify a case maybe in another country or sort of sniff something out where there may be some money in a class action settlement could be in the offing. They'll file a suit, and then oftentimes they'll go find a company to join the class action and lead the class action. Did you find it surprising, John, that there was a settlement here, or just in reading the justification for that settlement, did that make sense to you?
I understand the justification. I don't like the continued precedent being set. And by that, I mean Maui settled in another class action lawsuit, I think it was last year, $1.3 million. Now, this was not price fixing. This was misleading advertising for claiming that their products are produced sustainably. So they settled for that. And I just think once you begin to do that, I think, as you mentioned before, there's a whole cadre of these attorneys out there, these law firms that look for this quick money, if you will. When they see people giving in and crying uncle and settling, I think that emboldens them more. I could be completely wrong on that, but I mean, that's generally what I've read and what I've seen in the past. So no, I don't like the idea of settling, but then again, I'm not running these companies. I don't know the financial exposure from years more of litigation and things like that. And, you know, litigation does not in any way guarantee that you're going to win the case. I mean, anybody will tell you, once it goes to court, it's a 50-50. So yeah, that's just the way I see it.
Right. I mean, you know, the fact that the EU sort of kicked this off with a raid of some offices there in Scotland, you know, that to me sort of sets an interesting precedent in motion. You mentioned the U.S. Department of Justice, which has been more and more in recent years aggressive on price fixing and aggressive on these issues, even under the really under the Trump administration, it was quite active. And of course, the big win, the biggest win, and certainly in my time here, and I would venture to say historically, the biggest price fixing case was against the big three tuna companies. And they ended up also settling, but not before executives ended up in jail. So, as you say, maybe sometimes it's best to get out in front of these things and settle them. But we just don't know how far it's going to go. We don't know the timeline. The EU is always opaque about when these things will happen because of the bureaucracy. So it could be years before we hear anything on the EU and what their view is on this alleged collusion. The DOJ, similarly, they can look for years because the cases against the tuna companies stretch back a long time.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting the point you bring up about executives serving jail time. Obviously, we know Chris Lushewski from Bumblebee is still in prison, will be for a bit more related to that case. And I just, you know, I start to wonder, okay, what if it was a Norwegian salmon company executive? Can they imprison that person if they're in Norway? You know, there's just a lot of questions around this. And again, I'm not sure settling, even though you suggest that you weren't guilty or anything like that. I think most people, when they see settle, they think there's some guilt associated. Whether it's true or not, it just gives that perception. So in the long run, I'm not sure they did themselves any favors. But then again, I'm not running these companies, so I don't really know inside and out.
Well, before we freak out the Norwegian salmon CEOs about going to prison, I think it's important listeners to contextualize Mr. Fiorillo a bit. And it was, I mean, the documents that were released in the tuna price fixing case, I mean, guns don't smoke any more than the smoking guns that were alleged in that case. Now, they've all been denied, all those, or at least, as you said, John, they've settled. There's been some admission of guilt and some that have pled absolutely not guilty, including Lushewski, who you mentioned. It's just important to let the listeners know that there would need to be some serious smoking guns. Now, who knows, or maybe I have not seen any indication or heard any indication over the past few years of us covering this that there is anything along those lines, but of course you never know. But I think that with the tuna case as well, what is different about that is it was referencing a single market and a nearly, you know, an absolutely almost identical product, you know, sitting next to one another in the shelves. So this will be harder. But then again, as you said, John, sometimes when you get in front of a jury, or sometimes when the DOJ, I mean, you have to think about all the things that come across the Department of Justice's transom, and they're as likely to make decisions that are short-sighted as well as any other government. They may just say, okay, we're gonna get this group on collusion because we haven't had a good collusion case in a while. These are touted as victories, you know, when the U.S. Department of Justice, you know, makes these allegations and then wins, they are proud of that, because I think they like to flex their muscle and send messages to the industry, or to the larger business community that these things are being watched. Now, there is no, you know, there's been no charges filed by the Department of Justice. But the fact that there is a criminal investigation, you know, that says that they're being looked at closely. And the outcome of that will be interesting, because that will inform what the EU, does. And there'll be some sorts of coordination, I'm sure, on how they do that investigation. But yeah, let's see.
Well, you know, before we close the door on this, the salmon collusion in general just kind of surprises me, because, at least in my experience, I don't think there's any species where price transparency is so obvious. I mean, there's you know, different agencies and groups who track this and publish this information all the time. I mean, we do a report every week. So it's not like, you know, just because the market moves in one direction doesn't mean the prices are being fixed. And it's not impossible by any stretch of the imagination to know the salmon price, you know, from week to week, or probably from even day to day. So this one always struck me as odd. So I don't know. We'll just have to see, I guess.
That's a good point. I mean, the transparency is a really important part of how these decisions are made. Again, I suppose that when you settle, you just look at the lawyer's fees and the time and the effort, et cetera. And, you know, $85 million, while it's a lot of money, is a drop in the bucket for those companies, particularly when you look at their first quarter earnings. I mean, that's nothing. That'll barely show up on their quarterly earnings. But as you said, the transparency of the market is going to, I think, make it difficult for any sort of larger scale case to succeed if the Department of Justice or the European Commission decide to press any further on this, because, as you said, there is Fishpool NASDAQ, there is Norwegian seafood export statistics. So many people track the price publicly. These are publicly listed companies, all of them. And so it's very, very easy to get information on their earnings and on their strategies and on how contracts work and on spot markets, etc. So I think this is going to be a tough one to prove, but as you said, you know, the settlement is, we'll see in the future if that ended up being a good idea, but hopefully the salmon company attorneys here in the United States have told them that the U.S. is a litigious country. And when there's money to be had, there's a lot of attorneys that will line up and say, wait a minute. Hey, they just settled for $85 million. That sounds like a great opportunity to get some legal fees if we find another way to file a suit on this. And there's always little ways to twist and tweak and find, you know, different ways to file suits. So should be interesting.
Yep.
Well, okay, let's switch over. John Evans, you know, one of the, another legal case stretching back, I would say at least 10 years, maybe 12 years, is a story of Spanish seafood giant Pescanova. Now, if you recall, the implosion of Pescanova, one of the largest seafood companies in the world at the time, I believe it had well over €1 billion euros in revenue, with its tentacles kind of stretched all around the world in a lot of different businesses, the CEO was found guilty of all kinds of layers of mismanagement, The company went bankrupt. It was stock listed. A lot of people lost their shirt. A lot of jobs were lost. And it was unclear that the company would ever be anything again in the future. But the company Nueva Pescanova, New Pescanova, was established. And the idea was to just find whatever the husk was that was left and build up a viable company from there. And that also was under question of how the banks were going to get their money, how all this was going to work out. But it does appear under the new CEO, Ignacio Gonzalez, that things are moving a bit more onto the right track. Their earnings just came out today and showed some positive development, not just versus last year, but versus the pre-pandemic year of 2019. But John, you've been tracking them closely, and you sat down with Gonzalez in Barcelona last month. So tell us a bit about his view and what he thinks about this kind of, I guess you could say, new era.
Yeah, as you mentioned, Drew, a rare interview indeed. And he says that the outlook for the fishing, aquaculture and seafood processing giant is financial future is bright following the takeover by Spanish banker Bankia, as you mentioned. Early last year, Bankia capitalized all the bankruptcy debt in Nueva Pescanova after taking a 97% stake in the company, setting the stage for growth. And as you mentioned, the financial results just out this week show that its EBITDA doubled to 80 million euros and revenue was up 21%. And also, as you mentioned, the revenues were up four. Good news indeed that the revenues were up 4 point, over 4%. Compared with the pre-pandemic, and that was helped by retail, wholesale, and food service business rebounding, and company particularly quoting markets such as Portugal, France, Greece, and the United States for that. Of course, the company's been busy launching new products as well, including its Pasta del Mar range, a blitz of new products, actually 57, I think I remember reading yesterday. So a lot going on there at the moment. Yeah.
Now, I mean, it was quite interesting too, just looking back on the entire saga, which we spent a lot of ink following. I mean, it was absolutely fascinating. The CEO, then CEO Manuel Fernandez de Souza, he ended up being sentenced to 8 years in prison, had all kinds of money kind of squirreled away here and there. And the allegations with were that the debt that had been hidden was 3.6 billion euros as part of the collapse, which is just kind of stunning. So, we're talking about not a small hole that the company has had to dig itself out of. Now, in terms of Gonzalez, I mean, we talked to him sort of about his about the company's plans and how things are going forward and what sort of underpins the future. So, what were his thoughts on kind of where he takes the company now and kind of the focus areas? It's still a very diverse company, but it does seem like that he's got a strategy for growth that has some particular elements to it.
Yeah, I mean, one particular element, which I won't speak about too much because we're going to put a piece out on it next week, is focusing on the company's aquaculture strategy, which is made up of two parts, a two-pronged strategy, if you like. That's very interesting, based around technology and the hunt for new kinds of seafood. One of which we've first seen developments on recently with the as the company moves forward, trying to commercialize octopus, which is growing in certain markets of the world. So that's one area. That's one area of it. And they've been very sort of They've been very quick to put their case forward in terms of defending that from environmental groups who've been, made various allegations against octopus farming, and they say that, that doesn't coincide with the science. You know, they say that accusations made by critics are not founded in science, and that they're discovering many new things because they're pioneers. But, that will be what remains to be seen, because they haven't said which markets they're going to target at this moment. What they have said that they're aiming to start production next year in the Canary Islands.
Yeah, I found that pretty fascinating. I mean, I think it's there's so many different species that are that there's been research and advances on in farming they're always in the background, and you kind of never know when they're going to complete the life cycle or the farming cycle for it. But until your interview, I hadn't realized they were quite so far along.
Yeah, as you said, Drew, they're now in their fifth generation, so they have completed the cycle, now it's a matter of if they can do it, to scale it up and then to start commercializing it.
Right. And I mean, this is kind of interesting because Pescanova has traditionally been a fishing company. That's where its roots are. But obviously, like so many large companies, I mean, they have a pretty strong foothold in aquaculture and have ambitions to grow. So they have turbot farming as well in Spain, and then also a pretty sizable shrimp farming footprint in Ecuador, Nicaragua, and Guatemala as well. So I wouldn't be surprised if we see them continue to expand more in that segment of production. And in fact, they just launched a new aquaculture R&D center there, I believe in Vigo, or at least nearby their headquarters somewhere.
In Galicia, yeah, which I talk about a little bit in the report I'm putting out next week. And just on that strategy of aquaculture. I mean, what he did say to me, and he's sort of repeating what he said in earlier corporate videos, is that the Spanish Chef haven't been always known hitherto for their awareness of sustainability issues when it comes to the sea and seafood, or even carry them out. But I mean, Gonzalez is now saying sustainability is not a company strategy; it is the company strategy, and a part of that is building up the aquaculture side of the business.
Right, right. Well, thanks, John. It's been really interesting coverage. Your interviews with Gonzalez, and as you said, it's rare to find time to interview him and get a look into what's happening in particular on the Spanish market, which really operates. It's a relatively insular sector. And so I have noticed with Gonzalez that he's putting much more effort into communicating and sort of showing that the company is aware of its different divisions in different countries, which I think is just in general a really important effort that we're seeing a few fisheries companies make. To ensure that they're not sort of, they don't have their international operations kind of squirreled away and hidden, that they're actually highlighting them and ensuring that they have the same level of transparency as their other operations. So it's not uncommon for some of these larger conglomerates to have, for example, fishing operations off the coast of Africa and stay pretty opaque about those because, you know, maybe they don't want to talk about what exactly goes on there. And we've certainly seen over the years some scandals and things cropping up about those types of relationships. So, yeah, great stuff. Look forward to next week's story. A reminder, too, we just finished our New York Seafood Investor Forum. That was on May 25th. It was a fantastic event. It was really great to see people in person. And it was a fantastic crowd and great panelists and speakers. So our coverage of that is rolling out over the coming days. So we've had a couple of pieces looking at salmon prices and demand. A great piece today that John Evans wrote up from the presentation of Salmar Aker Ocean and their offshore ambitions, which are really fascinating and much closer to reality than one might think. And speaking of that, there will be other coverage of the panels and the presentations. As I mentioned, one coming up will be on alternative seafood. That was one of my favorite panels to moderate. So fascinating. I learned so much about where cell-based seafood in particular is in the evolution of commercialization. And I think the bottom line, I mean, I won't give away too much of what you're going to be writing about, John, but I think the bottom line that I took away is that it's way closer than we might think. And so we'll chat about that more next week on the podcast. So John Evans, Mr. Fiorillo, thanks for joining. Thanks all you listeners. A reminder, we get great feedback from the industry out there on the podcast, and we really appreciate that. If you go to our podcast in the iTunes Store or Google Play and subscribe or give us a review, we would appreciate that as well. And that helps other people find us and helps us reach more of the industry out there. All right, folks, we'll speak to you next time.